Hello, hi, and welcome to the Emma Gunn Show. It's me, it's Emma. I'm your host, Emma Gunn Wardner, and I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Shelby Harris onto this episode of the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. Well, several. Have you ever had trouble sleeping? Maybe you've gone through a spell of stress-related insomnia, really struggled to get back on track after jet lag, or just had a week or so or a few nights in a row where your sleep has been really disrupted or poor and it's made you feel rubbish during the day. Well, Shelby is a licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. So she really is the ideal person to chat to about what's normal with sleep, when there's an issue, how to create the best environment for a good night's sleep, and much more. Also, crucially, how to dial it back from bad sleep to good sleep, or better sleep at least. She's also written a book, The Women's Guide to Overcoming Insomnia, Get a Good Night's Sleep Without Relying on Medication. And I was really interested in the first instance to ask whether insomnia was more of a female issue and also unpick the bit about not relying on medication. Like, can you really achieve optimum sleep without a little bit of help? Apparently so. I found it extremely comforting speaking to Shelby and also reading her book. Incidentally, she writes in a way that answers your questions as you have them, which makes her book a real page turner. And it's comforting for me because, like a lot of people I've spoken to, sleep is the first thing to go when I'm feeling stressed, have too much on my plate, or maybe I'm feeling run down. And speaking to Shelby, I was able to understand when a bad night's sleep is completely normal and nothing to worry about, and when it's something to have a little bit more of a think about. It also really flagged up to me how little effort I actually put into getting a good night's sleep, or worse, how I do things with the intention of getting a better night's sleep that actually work against me. And also how sort of cavalier I am about sleep compared to diet and exercise, when actually it's hugely important to my and our health. This conversation and the book has definitely made me reassess all aspects of sleep and how I nurture my sleep habits. The links to the book and to Dr. Shelby Harris will be in the show notes, but I hope you find this episode as useful, helpful and comforting as I did. I actually want Shelby to come back on a million times to talk about sleep because I do think it is a fundamental pillar of wellness. But here she is for the first time, hopefully, the wonderful Dr. Shelby Harris on The Emma Gunn Show. Dr. Shelby Harris, welcome to the Emma Gunn Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma.
I'm really, really pleased that I'm going to be talking to you because the subject of sleep, I think, is probably something that everybody can relate to on a very emotional level.
Uh-huh.
We all do it.
We all do it or should do it.
Yes.
That's the problem.
But it is, I mean, a frequent expression I hear from people is, oh, the second I'm stressed, my sleep goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to, it's one of our fundamental pillars for being well.
Yeah.
Yet it can be one of the first thing that shows signs of fragility when other aspects of our lives are out of whack. And you have spent a long time studying it.
Yes, I have.
So really, there is no one better to unpick sleep with. So just to put you into context for listeners, how long have you been studying sleep?
Well, So I've been practicing for about 15-ish, maybe even longer, years at this point. And I was a director of a behavioral sleep medicine program at a hospital just outside of New York City. And I was there for about a decade. So I've been doing this for a while, working with just sleep patients. And now I'm in private practice and I see patients with sleep disorders, but I also see anxiety and depression. I just wanted a little more variety, but I've been seeing sleep disorders for 15-ish years or more.
And are they all linked? Is that why the anxiety and depression is kind of...
Very linked. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, or actually a lot of times I find, and this is what I did at the sleep center, if you treat someone's sleep, and you were alluding to this earlier, if you treat someone's sleep, a lot of times their anxiety and depression improves.
Mm.
You improve your sleep, your coping skills get better, you can deal with life better.
Yeah.
And so you don't always have to focus as much on anxiety and depression. But a lot of times there is other stuff going on too, and we need to address that as well. And that's why I liked doing it more in practice on the side.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all so, so interesting. And as you said, listeners, I was saying to Shelby, Dr. Harris, earlier.
Shelby.
Please. That I've suffered with insomnia and really disrupted, interrupted sleep for a long time. And that's when I know, well, I need to look at other things in my life, because that's why sleep's being affected.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes that is important to do. I mean, it's always important to do that, to look at all the areas of your life and look at your stress, anxiety levels, depression, whatever it might be, medical. There can be a million reasons why people have insomnia. And sometimes I have patients that come to me and they cannot pinpoint any reason why it might develop. Sometimes you just have insomnia. You just don't know why. And yes, you might have to address those other factors, but sometimes you don't have to. You have to address the things behaviorally that you're doing that might be making the insomnia keep going on and on and on.
And it's not that you're doing anything wrong. Like, if somebody's listening to this and they're experiencing insomnia, you might not be doing, they might not be doing anything wrong. Like, it's okay. It happens.
Yeah, it happens. It's super common. I've had insomnia myself. It's something that we just, we're humans. I say this to my patients all the time. I don't sleep perfect every night. We just have to know when we're starting to have trouble and what are the things we can do to get ourselves back on track to fix it.
Yeah. Now, one of the reasons that we are talking is because you've got this brilliant book.
Thank you.
That I was saying to Shelby before we started recording, every chapter I read, I would think, oh, I really want to know the answer to these questions. And then I'd start the next chapter and lo and behold, we clearly have a similar thought process. Yeah. But the book is called The Women's Guide to Overcoming Insomnia. And insomnia actually is, unfortunately, more likely to affect women.
Yeah, it is. At a rate of 3 to 2 times more than men. It's really, it's a problem. And we've always just kind of lumped it together, just insomnia, that everyone has it. But really, we need to focus on it for women more too.
And what is that potentially? Is it because of hormones? Is it because of load bearing everything?
You hit it. There's a few reasons. Hormones are one really big reason, and that is throughout the lifespan. So we actually see insomnia rates, so trouble sleeping, we see equal in children and young adolescents. Once we reach adolescence and our hormones for women, we start to have estrogen levels and progesterone levels start to change, and women start to, or young adolescents, I should say, start to hit menstruation. That's when we actually see women start to have more rates of insomnia over men. And it's during that time of menstruation, just before some women have trouble sleeping for about 3 to 5 days just before they menstruate. And that can happen month after month. So that's a very common time for insomnia for women. And then pregnancy, you're uncomfortable. Stress is a big one, right? I hear from people, myself included. You're in your first trimester, you're having to urinate all the time at night. You just hormone changes. You're napping during the day. You can't sleep at night. And then when you're in your third trimester, you're uncomfortable, right? You're just, I mean, there's no way to get around the fact that you have a big tummy and you just can't get comfortable at night, peeing again throughout the night. And then your brain, I had dreams and nightmares about how am I going to take care of this baby? My brain was almost trying to prepare myself for the upcoming childbirth. And so sleep really gets lost then. And then the other two big stages when we tend to have big sleep changes are after the baby comes, right? Women, it's normal to not sleep well. You're breastfeeding a lot of the time, or you're feeding a baby throughout the night. Babies don't know night versus day. And then as time goes on, women sometimes, a lot of my friends, myself included, have this issue. They tend to worry about their child at night, and then, or whatever else they have to do, even though the child might not have any issues, it might be sleeping fine. They don't sleep fine. They're always keeping an ear out. So they don't sleep well. Insomnia develops then. And then we start to hit perimenopause. So that's when hormones change drastically again. We start to have estrogen drops, progesterone drops, hot flashes. A lot of women will report that they wake up in the middle of the night and their mind is just racing. They're dripping in sweat and they can't go back to sleep. So throughout the life, from adolescence all the way until menopause, we tend to have major stages when we can have more insomnia than men. It stinks.
It really does. It really does. And actually, in terms of perimenopause, and you mentioned estrogen and progesterone levels changing, that's normally what happens just before you menstruate. So it would make sense that the disruption of the 3 to 5 days that you mentioned before your period would manifest itself as a bigger issue when those levels were really being affected by
100%.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. That it's all the hormone drops. The big swings is really what can affect the sleep problems. Yeah.
But the good news is, listeners, because it might sound doom and gloom, I know a lot of you are women, hello to the men, is that there are things that you can do, practical things that you can change. There are tweaks that can be made to lifestyle. Yeah. You've got some really useful tips. I love sleep hygiene, but we're going to get on to all of that.
Yeah, they're useful tips. And then the other reason I decided to write the book too is that there's a lot of misnomers out there. Like some women just think that they're the only ones who are suffering from mm-hmm. sleep problems during perimenopause or after having a baby. It's weird. Like at least from the people that I work with, some women just don't talk about it. I don't know why. They power through and they think they're talking about sleep disorders or not being able to sleep is a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
And I wanted women to know that, okay, having sleep problems during perimenopause or after babies or whatever is actually, there's a normal aspect to it. Some things can be treated. Some things are a little bit more difficult. Mm. Sometimes you have to ride it out. Sometimes there are things we can really do that are effective.
That's so comforting
yeah.
to know that it's normal. And I think, yeah, I do think sometimes I find it really interesting that a lot of the vocabulary that we use, like if I see you next year and you say, oh, how are you, Ems? How's it been going? I'd probably say, oh, I'm busy, mm-hmm. tired. So we use vocabulary like that yeah. as like a badge of honor, but we don't then take a step back from the I'm tired and go, oh, because maybe I'm not sleeping right, because maybe I'm eating too late
yeah.
or I'm on my phone all the time.
Yeah, maybe there's actually something we're doing that's creating part of the problem.
So it's interesting that you say that, you know, the identifying the sleep problem is yeah. only one step away from that. I'm tired.
Yeah, exactly. It's so true. It's really true.
But maybe we're not unpicking it as much. So
yeah.
Also, you've worked in this field for a long time, mm-hmm. but you also have your own personal experience of this.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why you're so passionate and is the thing that you do as an adult?
Yeah, that's one reason. The main reason I initially started getting into it was that I was a big sleepwalker as a kid. So when I was, I want to say 6, 7, 8 years old. And it's normal to be a sleepwalker as a child. Sleep talker, that stuff can happen for a little while. I was pretty bad at it. I always had to have a bottom bunk at camp. I remember vaguely, usually when you sleepwalk, you have no recollection or only a tiny recollection. Mm. I remember trying to leave my parents' house and then opening up the sliding glass door in the back. And I just remember
oh, wow.
setting off the alarm and then my dad like waking me up because he had a bat and thought there was a burglar there. And I mean, it wasn't good. So I did a lot of those sorts of behaviors. And I was, when I grew, I finally grew out of it and I was just really fascinated with it. And then when I went to college, there was a really big sleep researcher there. And then when I went and did a little bit of research working with people who had alcoholism, we found that when they were in rehab, if we treated their insomnia right after they left rehab, their relapse rates to alcohol actually dropped significantly. Because one reason that people often go back to alcohol right after leaving rehab is that they're complaining they can't sleep anymore. And so they go back to the alcohol to help them sleep. Mm-hmm. So if we treat their insomnia using something else, it helps to reduce their relapse rates. So I found just treating sleep to be so powerful in so many areas that that's why I do it to this day.
I mean, it is a really powerful, it's a fundamental pillar of wellness, right?
100%.
Just yeah. being well.
But it's fascinating to me because at least where I am in the States, we're so focused on diet and exercise as being a pillar of wellness, but we don't talk about sleep. We're starting to talk about sleep more, but we really don't talk about it as much as we should, because the reality is if you sleep better, the diet and the exercise, you get better benefits from them.
Yes, because you're not going to crave sweet stuff if you... Okay,
exactly.
Right. There's so much to unpick here. So just in order to create some sort of clarity over insomnia
yeah.
and sleep, insomnia isn't an umbrella term, is it? It's quite a specific definition, or it covers
yeah.
a lot?
I mean, people will talk about it like, oh, I had insomnia last night, meaning they just didn't sleep last night. But the actual clinical term of insomnia, it typically is usually more than 2 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 or more nights a week where you're not sleeping. And what does that mean? It's you're having trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, or you wake up too early. But it also has to create a problem for you. So whether you're just annoyed by it, you feel like you have some fogginess or memory problems during the day, you're calling in sick to work, it has to create some problem, irritability. Mm-hmm. That's when that's happening more than three or more nights a week for a few months on end, that's when you actually have chronic clinical insomnia.
Oh, okay.
So it's normal to have a bad night here and there.
Right.
And I have a bad night here and there. And that's okay. But when it's happening multiple times a week, then you want to get it addressed because it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Individual variability from night to night is not necessarily a reason to start medicating yourself left and right.
Okay. And we will come on to that later for sure. But sleep disorders would be grouped as would that be sleepwalking? And would that be...
Oh, there's a whole bunch of different types of sleep disorders. So you could have insomnia, mm-hmm. like we were just talking about. You could have sleepwalking, sleep talking. There's nightmare disorders. So I'd see a lot of patients who have chronic nightmares, and then they have insomnia on top of that because now they're scared to go to sleep, mm. or they wake up because of a nightmare and they can't go back to sleep. There's sleep apnea, which is extremely common. So people who snore at night, and they might be really sleepy during the day or just feel like their sleep is unrefreshing. Or there are some people who have insomnia, and this is really important, that some people have insomnia, they wake up, but they're actually waking up because they're snoring and they don't realize it. So if you're someone who snores, or you have a spouse or a significant other or a bed partner who's telling you that you snore, and maybe there's a little bit of pausing in your breathing or choking or gasping that's happening, you definitely want to get that evaluated, because that could be contributing to your insomnia or you're feeling very fatigued the next day as well. And sleep apnea is super common.
I think that's another thing as well, as I posed this question in the Facebook group for the podcast about the fact that I was going to be speaking to you. And a lot of the comments that came back were, sleeping but not feeling refreshed, mm-hmm. or sleeping 10 hours, still feeling terrible, or sleeping really well, but then really needing a nap by 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
So that would imply that somewhere along the line, maybe the quality of sleep is...
Yeah. So if you feel like you're getting a good amount of sleep on a regular basis, and one thing to note is that you're not taking anything that mm-hmm. could be impacting it. So a lot of people will have alcohol before going mm-hmm. to bed or within 3 hours. That's going to impact the quality of it. A lot of caffeine can impact the quality of your sleep. Sometimes people are taking medications that could impact the quality of sleep. But if you're still having poor quality sleep and you're getting a lot on a regular basis, not just one night and you're still tired the next day, mm-hmm. but at least in a week or two, go see your physician, because there might be something else going on that's impacting the quality.
But then I watched this report. Actually, it was in the links, and I was doing my research on you. Prescriptions for sleeping aids are actually given quite freely.
Yeah.
I guess because it's a quick fix, you're having a bad night's sleep, it can be solved pretty much tomorrow by tomorrow morning.
Yes.
Or it can seem as though it is.
Yes. The sleep aids, you know, I can speak for it in the States mostly. Mm. They're very common. It's been a very common quick fix, but it's starting to swing in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. The type of treatment that I do, cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, is now in our primary care system. That is the first line treatment, more so than medication. That's actually what's recommended to be for the treatment for insomnia, wow. more so than medication. Problem is, there aren't many people who are super qualified to do it. Mm. So there aren't many of me around, and that's a big problem. But we do find that when you use medication, there are some people who just are using it for too many years, mm-hmm. and it can become a dependence issue. But it can, for some people, they love it. We don't know what the long-term effects are typically, mm-hmm. but a lot of people are finding, the people that come to me usually, are finding that they're feeling groggy the next day. They're mm-hmm. feeling a little bit foggy, mm-hmm. even, and they just don't like how they're sleeping, but they don't love how they feel on it. And if you do have any of that snoring issue that's going on, some of the medications can actually worsen the snoring or sleep apnea. So you do want to get all that evaluated regardless.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. It's not simple.
Yes. Okay. So let's, because you also talked then about red wine and caffeine and things, yeah. and you call them sleep stealers.
Sleep stealers, yeah.
Which I really, really like. Now, you talked about your issues as a child with sleepwalking, and we kind of already said this off tape, but I wanted for the benefit of the listeners to say, if you struggle with sleep, might it be the case that your children then might potentially inherit?
Yeah, insomnia is a tricky one. We don't really, you're not necessarily going to have a child who has insomnia if you have insomnia. But that being said, anxiety, depression tend to be very hereditary. Mm. And if you have that, you might pass that on. Mm. But sleepwalking disorders, sleep talking, night terrors, those are very hereditary. We were saying earlier, my daughter, I'm starting to notice she's 4. She's having a lot of like this sleep talking at night and doing some sleepwalking behavior. So I'm trying to keep the environment as safe as possible and putting up gates at the top of our stairs and trying to make sure she gets enough sleep on a regular basis. If you're someone who sleep talks or sleepwalks, sometimes medication can get in the way. You have to make sure medically you're fine. But in kids, it's often that it's just a developmental thing. And you have to make sure they're getting enough sleep on a regular basis.
How can somebody prioritize their sleep in order to maximize it without becoming boring? Because I feel like...
I know.
I feel like that might be an obstacle of just, oh, I go to bed at the same time every night. I turn my phone off an hour before I go to bed. It seems like quite boring stuff.
Right.
even though the rewards that you reap from doing it are obviously huge.
Right.
But do you find that that's a barrier that you experience with people sometimes?
Okay. Good. Yeah, I'm highly boring to many people. I try to just like with diet and exercise, you have to look at it. That's why I'm such a big fan of trying to consider it one of those pieces of wellness, right? Mm-hmm. If you can do it most days, that's the goal. Right. So if you can aim to try and be consistent, most days you will reap the benefits. And the other thing is that, yes, on the weekend, you know, it's not necessarily ideal to lose out on 3-4 hours of sleep. And if you're someone who's having trouble sleeping most nights, especially Sunday nights, a lot of people have Sunday night insomnia, you're probably staying up too late Friday or Saturday night, and then you're sleeping in Saturday, Sunday, and you're not up enough hours on Sunday during the day to be able to go to bed at the time you want come Sunday night. So you do have to make it a priority if you want to better your sleep in the long run. But just try to do most days of the week. If you can do most days, you'll get at least more benefit than not. But if you don't do it, you're not going to get the benefits. I mean, it is what it is.
And like you say, so if you're looking after your diet, if you're exercising, it's a really important step to try and maximize your sleep. So what is the first thing? If someone comes to you and they say, look, Dr. Harris, I'm sleeping terribly and I feel like it's impacting my life. Yeah. Where do you begin?
That's a great question. It really depends upon the person. A lot of my patients will do that sleep in sort of thing on the weekend. So I start with just trying to regularize some sort of a sleep schedule for them. That's where I start usually. So we're not going to have you sleep in 3-4 hours on the weekend if you're someone who has insomnia. So there's the basic sleep hygiene stuff, which, you know, alcohol, limiting alcohol, heavy meals. But I really try to get them to wake up at the same time 7 days a week. It's not easy. It's really not easy. But if you start doing that, you're going to really help yourself come Sunday, Monday night.
It's circadian rhythms, and it's because ultimately human beings as a mammal are, we're mammals, aren't we?
Yeah. We are.
Sorry, listeners. Brain moment. We are, we're creatures of habit.
Yeah. I always say to my patients, we're born to live in a cave. I mean, that's really what was meant to happen. We are born to live with light cycles. When the sun goes down, shortly after we go to bed, we wake, and then we wake up when the sun starts to come up. The invention of alarm clocks and modern technology with going and having one schedule for the week and then shift. It's almost like we think we have a switch in our backs that we can have like weekday time zone and then weekend time zone. And we haven't adjusted to that. There are some people who can do that no problem. But if you're someone whose sleep is really not great, you're just more sensitive to it. And you really need to be consistent. I must say a million times in my book that consistency is key. And that's really what our bodies crave, to keep all of those time clocks in our cells on the right schedule to help everything line up perfectly.
It's like we've tried to buck the system. And even with something like, I was listening to an interview with Dr. Rhonda Patrick recently about something completely different about intermittent fasting. And it was the data that's come back about people who work on split shifts and really, really break that circadian rhythm and the instances of basically ill health.
It's really not good. Our bodies are meant to be awake during the day, sleep at night, and not shift it for just 2 days on the weekend. And it means jet lag. It's essentially what we're trying to do. And we need to be consistent as often as we can.
Yeah, my first question to Shelby when I saw her today was, because she's only been in London for 2 days, is how's the jet lag? And you were like, well, we're not supposed to fly across the world, really.
Yeah, we're not. We're not meant to just travel across the world in, what, 6-7 hours?
Skip a few time zones.
I mean, the rule of thumb, really, that I tell everyone is that number of time zones crossed is number of days it usually takes to fully adjust.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. So some people can do it no problem, and they're those lucky few people. But really, I can't even diagnose someone with jet lag disorder unless they've been suffering for 2 weeks. It's normal to take some time to adjust.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about getting up and going to sleep at the same time every day, because we know that this is a really good practice.
Yeah.
Can you be a little bit fast and loose with that, like half an hour either side?
Yeah. You can, yeah. I mean, it's a half hour on the weekends, you know, that's fine. But a lot of people just try to sleep in. And if they normally wake up at, let's say, 6:30, 7 a.m. on a weekday, they're trying to sleep until 9, 10 in the morning on weekend. That's when you're starting to get too greedy. But half-hour, hour is not going to make a huge difference in the long run, if you're a good sleeper overall.
What's a good thing to do on the weekend if you're, like, my alarm's gone off, I don't want to get up at the same time as I do for work, but is there something you can do? Is there a good habit to get into that gets you up and out of bed?
Right. If you're an exerciser, morning exercise is great. So I have two little kids at home. My husband, the weekend mornings are his mornings with the kids. I run with a running group. So they know that we all are meeting on Saturday and Sunday mornings pretty early. We usually meet at about 8 a.m., but sometimes we do extra miles and we'll meet even earlier. And I know that there are people there waiting for me. So I have some accountability to get up and be there. I'm a big fan of that. I also have some patients because I work just outside of New York City. So I have patients that I try to get them to see, well, now you can actually use the laundry in your building and it'll be empty. Mm. Like try to do things and maximize that time. But I'm a big fan of just doing classes. If there's a workout class, if there's anything that you can go to, have a friend. A lot of women have insomnia. A lot of women are getting up early anyways. Mm. Have a friend that you can meet for coffee, for breakfast. Try and do something on a regular basis if you can. And if you have little kids at home, I know you're tired, but maybe just get out and sit on the couch with them at least. Just get out of bed. Mm. That's going to be the first step.
Interestingly about exercise, I think sometimes if I'm tired or struggling to sleep, I think, well, I'll wear myself out.
Yeah.
But if one is already experiencing disrupted sleep, might you already be in a state of, well, let's ask you this. Does overtiredness actually exist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Overtired. You see it a lot in kids. Mm. So they don't look sleepy. They look like they're running around like just crazy, essentially.
Jacked up on something. Yeah.
That's actually a sleepy child. Mm. And we can, as adults, we can get overtired too, but it's just hard for us to always recognize it. Mm. But exercise is a funky one. So exercise in the morning doesn't hurt or help sleep really. I use it more as just a timing thing for me because it's the only time I can really do it. And I get up early in the morning and I work out. But if you want to exercise, some people do that kind of, I'm going to do it so I can tire myself out, but they do it within 3 hours of going to bed.
Yes.
So they do it right before and they go like, I'm going to take this great class. It's actually going to hurt the quality of your sleep you get because what you're doing is you're warming your body up and then you're not having enough time to cool off before you go to bed. And what we need to do is actually have our bodies cool off about an hour and a half to 2 hours before we go to bed. And the reason that happens is our body temperature cools off throughout the night and it reaches a drop right before we wake up in the morning. And melatonin, have you ever heard of melatonin? Mm. So melatonin is made in our brains. It's not just a pill that you can get as a prescription or over the counter, depending where you are. Melatonin comes out when the sun goes down. That's why we need darkness to sleep. But it comes out when our body temperature starts to drop and it makes us sleepy. So if you're working out just before bed, trying to make yourself all tired, you're raising your body temperature. You're making your melatonin and other things in your body not sleep inducing. Mm. So I actually recommend people to work out about 4 to 6 hours before bedtime instead. So then you're having some time to raise your body temperature and then you have now 4 hours or so to cool off. So you get
it's good.
Yep. So that's actually where you see the best benefit for sleep.
Yeah. Interesting.
But it's not easy for a lot of people timing wise to do.
Can you cheat that? Because I am a big fan of cold showers.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm struggling to sleep, often it manifests in feeling fidgety.
Yeah.
And that's when I have a cold shower.
Cold shower. That's interesting. So a lot of people do hot showers. Mm. So they do it more to just like calm their brain or have patients who take hot baths. A cold shower tends to be a little too shocking for some people. Mm. What I usually end up having them do to cheat it is they'll do a hot bath for about 20 minutes, not scalding, but hot, about an hour and a half before bedtime. It works faster than the exercise. So an hour and a half to 2 hours before, you take a hot bath for 20 minutes, you warm yourself up, and then you cool off, and it works a little quicker. So it does the same sort of thing. And if you take a nice warm bath, that can be calming too. I'm all for people taking baths if it's calming and relaxing and you can make it into a meditative state for yourself.
Well, we must come on to mindfulness at some point during this because there are so many things that you can do. And all of these things, what you refer to as sleep hygiene.
Sleep hygiene is like, when you think about it as cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, which is a whole treatment package, one module of it, sleep hygiene. So that's the stuff that we often see in magazines or on TV, which is the, like, limit alcohol within 3 hours of bed, don't exercise or have heavy meals within 3 hours of bed, don't look at your phone. That's all helpful. But if you have really bad insomnia that's been going on for a while, usually changing that alone isn't going to make it. Right. Enough of a difference. Then we add in other things. We'll add in mindfulness. We can add in getting out of bed if you can't sleep. That's another big one that's hard for a lot of people to do, but it works really well. And then we'll change. This is the biggest thing that I do, is I change people's bedtimes and wake times. Mm-hmm. Completely change them based on how much sleep they're getting on average on a regular basis. So if you're coming to me only getting 5 hours of sleep a night, but you're in bed 8 or 9 hours every night, hoping that one night will be that magic night you get 9 hours, I'm going to have you be in bed 5 or 6 hours a night. And I'll give you a prescriptive window to be in bed every single night. And that's where I usually start with a lot of patients. I'll give them that sleep window to start with, and then we slowly increase it as they improve.
Oh, interesting.
It's an anti-common sense thing. So a lot of people develop insomnia. And when you develop insomnia, I always think of it as like you're doing whatever you can to cope with the fact that you're not sleeping. So you start taking medication, or you're having a glass of wine, or you're taking a nap, or sleeping in the morning because you just... you're trying to deal with the fact that you're not sleeping. But that's actually what's getting you in trouble in the long run. So then we try to go against common sense, because that's actually what fixes it.
Huh. So all the things that we think are going to help are actually working against us.
Exactly. And I think I might even say in the book, I don't remember, but it's so powerful that even for myself, if I have family members who don't sleep, and I'll look at them and I'll say, "You look so tired, go take a nap." And I have to stop myself, because I know that that's actually going to make it worse.
Oh, a nap's bad.
Naps, if you have horrible insomnia, they're bad. If you don't have any trouble sleeping, a 20-minute power nap before about 2 in the afternoon, what would that be here? I know, I always say 2 in the afternoon in the US. So 2 p.m. Would be fine. That's totally fine. So if you can do that, you're good. 20 minutes, not longer, because you do longer, you're actually going to wake up groggier.
I heard, and I've forgotten the gentleman who said it was on Tony Robbins' podcast, talk about, have you heard about this? The napspresso?
Yes, I call it, that's okay, coffee nap.
Coffee nap.
So that's actually, I hate to admit it, but that's what we use a lot. And like, because I worked in a hospital for a long time with people, with some of the physicians and residents who were working really long shifts. I have them take a cup of coffee, you drink it. Takes about a half hour for the caffeine to hit your system.
We're talking about more of a shot of coffee than like a milky drink, right?
Yeah. So you do that. It takes a half hour for the coffee to hit your system. So what you do is you take a nap right after you drink it. And then you wake up, you get the double effects.
You set your alarm. And then when you wake up, no grogginess, you're out the gate.
Exactly. But the big thing, and the thing is, though, a lot of the people that I work with then start to abuse it. And I always say you can't fake wake. So you can use it once in a while, but there's no substitute for a quality night of sleep.
I've just realized it's not a napspresso, it's a nappuccino.
Nappuccino. Obviously. I mean, those are funny terms. We just call it a coffee nap all the time in the sleep field. I mean, it's been around for years.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
This is the thing, is all of this expertise, whether it's by a podcast or just the fact that there's so much more media out there, we're getting access to the kind of tricks that professionals who work 20-hour shifts use.
Exactly. It's just stuff that I've been recommending to our residents for years.
Which is the thing that does make me think, Emma, I don't think you need to have a nappuccino. Yeah. Because actually, you don't have to be on shift dealing with people's health.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Is that there's also going to be days where you sleep fine and you're tired once in a while. I mean, I get tired, it's normal. But if you're feeling, and that's why, I mean, I drink coffee. It's okay. But if you're finding that you're needing it and you can't get through the day with, you know, a lot of coffee, all right, then you need to really start addressing what's going on. Is there a sleep quality, sleep quantity issue? Mm. What is the problem here?
Okay. Can we talk about the bedroom?
Love
and
it.
And talk about how to make the bedroom a place where one can.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Sleep. Mm-hmm. Because obviously it can be a place where lots of stuff happens.
Yeah.
There's media in there. There's a lot of light. Like, how do you make a bedroom your nest without it becoming just a bed and nothing much more.
I often tell people to make it a pretty cave, which sounds kind of, but that's how mine is, right? You want it quiet, dark, and cool, but also comfortable, right? So it has to be quiet. That's a key. Do whatever you can to block noise, whether that's using a white noise or a pink noise machine. You can get those online.
What is white noise and what is pink noise?
Yeah, that's a new thing. So white noise is just like a shh kind of noise that you would get on a, you can get them on a fan almost. But you can get it in like, you can get, we use them in therapist's office all the time. We put them right outside just to block the noise. But it's just a very gentle, constant shh noise.
Okay.
That's the key. And it's the steady, constant noise that you will get used to and be able to sleep through. People often get noises like jungle noises, or they'll sleep with the TV on. That inconsistency in volume and noise actually can wake you up and make your sleep quality worse.
Yeah.
So we don't want that. Earplugs, like silicone earplugs, are great. Anything to block the noise. Comfortable. So sheets, whatever you can afford, make it comfortable. We spend a third of our lives sleeping, or we're supposed to. Make it that you have a comfortable bed. If you have chronic insomnia, a mattress usually isn't going to solve your problem. But if you have a really old mattress that's just got a sagging point in the middle and it's just not comfortable, get a new mattress. Do what you can. Invest in what you can.
Is there a material that's better for your sheets in terms of optimizing that coolness?
Not really. I mean, it's really, a lot of it's personal preference. You'll see one that's recommended by one sleep doctor. There's no studies that show that one thing is better than another. It's really, I always say it's what's good for you. So what mattress is comfortable for you. There are people who will sleep, who need a $20,000 mattress to sleep. There are other people who will sleep on a floor with no problem. So try out a bunch of things. And what feels cool to you just is great. If you're someone who has hot flashes at night, think about the pajamas that you're wearing. So there are actual moisture wicking pajamas that you can get that are made of a special technical fabric, so you're not going to wake up soaked in sweat. And a cool room is really important. So whatever fan you can use, if you have air conditioning, that would be great. Sleep with a window open if it's not too noisy out. Try to optimize that environment. And then the darkness is really, really important. So a lot of people will get room darkening shades, but you need light blocking. You want it dark. And if you can't do that, try an eye mask. Do whatever you can to make it as dark as possible.
Does it make, does the darkness thing make that much of a difference?
It really does. If you close your eyes, you can still sense light coming through. And remember that melatonin that makes you sleepy, we call it the hormone of darkness. So it needs darkness to be sleepy.
Sounds like a rock band.
I know, it does. It's sleep inducing. So it stops coming out about 2 hours before you wake up, and it needs that light exposure to suppress the melatonin to help wake you up more. But when you start sensing light, you're going to start waking up. We're very sensitive to it. So I notice that I wake up a lot earlier if I can even see a little light coming through the sides of my shades. Yeah. So if you can do drapes on the sides, do whatever you can. I made sure that my kids' rooms are super, super, super dark.
See, I think as a kid, I used to quite like sleeping with the curtains open.
Yeah.
Because I used to quite like, if I woke up, I wasn't scared. It must be that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, there's a comfort issue for sure for that. But from day one, when I had my kids, I made sure that their room was really dark. But I also, you know, I'm not opposed to night lights, things like that. But that you can keep as a steady light at the same time. You're not changing the clock. A lot of people will come to me complaining that their kids are waking up at 5 a.m. and when it's the summertime. This is something that you can actually control a little bit better as opposed to the sun.
Obviously there are alarm clocks that wake up, make you up as if, I had one of those and I had to destroy it.
You did.
I really hated it.
You know what I use? I use that more for the dawn simulators. I use those for my night shift patients, or the ones who work at times where they have to get up when the sun is not out yet. So I'll have them, it tricks their brain into thinking that the day is coming.
That's really clever.
Yeah. So that's when I do use it. But yeah, for the rest of the patients, they have that same reaction.
Like, no.
Yeah.
Also, what is the kind of best way to ease your way into sleep? So is there a good nighttime routine that you should kind of begin to, you know, move towards?
It's whatever works for you. So but it's trying. I mean, the ideal, here's the ideal, and then I am also very much aware that many people don't have that time. I don't have it every night either. Try to allow for an hour, and if you can't do an hour, at least a half hour of dim light, stay away from screens is really the ideal. And try to go old school. I know the screens is a big one.
The way you say that tells me that it's the one thing that people lie to you about in
your office. It's so funny. It feels like so many people come to me and they're like, it's almost like they're in confession. So like halfway through, it's like, I got to tell you, I'm using my screen in the middle of the night. I didn't want to tell you, but I mean, it is what it is. And I get it, but there's two reasons that it's not great. So screens aren't great, mostly because of the blue light from them. So that melatonin that our brains are trying to make, you're suppressing it because it's like you're staring at the sun. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. So anything with a screen, that's a problem. But then there's also the stimulation aspect. So people are looking at it and now they're looking at social media and they're thinking and they're, you know, whatever it is that starts the brain going, and it can make it harder. And there's some studies that show that it can delay sleep onset by an hour. So yeah, it's not great. And it can worsen the quality of the sleep. And then people get so addicted to it that they wake up in the middle of the night with their phone, you know, that they have to check in the middle of the night, or they keep it on. So then they're getting texts throughout the night and they hear buzzing. I mean, it's just not great. I'm a huge fan, honestly, of people just buying an alarm clock. I've been saying this constantly, but I still use the same alarm clock I had in high school.
Really?
Yep. It still works. Digital
like a
alarm
wind
clock.
Oh,
no. A digital alarm clock. A digital alarm clock that I have next to my bed, and I use it to this day, and I love it. And I don't use my phone as an alarm clock. We don't need to use our phones as alarm clocks because it's just too tempting. So yeah, before bed, it's really whatever works for you. And try to do it if you have the space outside your bed. So I know that a lot of people live in studios or don't have a lot of space. Try to at least be outside your bedroom or outside your bed. You want to work your way to bed when it's actually bedtime. So to read, reading is wonderful. Listening to anything on your phone but not staring at the screen is fine. Relaxation exercises, meditation exercises. You just don't want to fall asleep to them.
Yeah.
That's the goal. You want to be able to fall asleep independently.
Is that also true for falling asleep to Joe Rogan?
I mean, it's what happens one day if you've listened to all the Joe Rogans, or you can't get one on your phone, your phone's out of battery. If you've trained yourself to need his voice to fall asleep, what's going to happen if his voice isn't there one day?
Yes.
That's the problem.
I see your point. This came up in the Facebook group, though, people saying that a particular listener said, my boyfriend needs complete quiet, but I do like to have something. And actually, her question was about comfortable sleep earphones so that she could still be plugged in.
Yeah. See, I'm not a fan of that personally.
Right.
I usually, honestly, because of the sleep timing, I prefer people to just go to bed a little later to time it with when you're actually really, really, really sleepy. You pair the bed now with being able to fall asleep.
Yeah.
So I'd rather someone sit and relax and listen to something where they're not falling asleep with it on their face, and then you get in bed and you fall asleep. It's more of a training sort of thing, because if you just need to rely on something to fall asleep, it's just what happens if it's not there that one day.
It's reminded me a little bit about recorded episodes recently about body positivity, and within that intuitive eating came up, and how we've forgotten, or we don't actually know when we're hungry.
Yes.
Because we override, and now it's, from what you're saying, it's making me think we don't actually know when we're tired.
Yes.
Does that also mean we don't know when we're not awake? Because obviously we know when we're awake. I mean, we don't know when we're alert.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. So a lot of people respond to being tired when they get in bed. But if you have some trouble sleeping, or even a lot of trouble sleeping, a lot of people respond to being tired when they go to bed, but they don't respond to actually being sleepy. And there's a difference. So tired is that feeling of, I just don't have any energy. I'm just done. But sleepy is where you actually are yawning. You can't keep your eyes open. That's the signal that people lose, and they're just not in tune with anymore. And that's why changing that bedtime, wake time, and I talk about how to figure that out and what that timing is in my book, that's what you really want to pair it with, instead of needing something to train you to be able to get sleepy.
So that's really interesting, the difference between tiredness.
Big difference.
And sleepiness.
Yes. And that's what people with insomnia who have trouble sleeping, that's what they often respond to when they go to bed. They respond to being tired, and that's why they don't fall asleep right away. It might take them a while to fall asleep. They're not actually sleepy. They just have no energy and they want to put an end to the day and just rest. But that's not what the bed's for.
And is getting into a routine the thing that will bring back that, i.e. understanding the hunger reflex, it will bring back the sleepy reflex?
100%. Yep. That's what I start to see. When people start getting better, they're complaining to me at the beginning of treatment, usually like 2-3 weeks in, they're like, I can't keep my eyes open. I'm falling asleep on the couch at 7 p.m. This is terrible. I'm like... How long has it been since you've actually felt sleepy? I said, this is great. this is what we want, but we just need to push it into the right time frame. Mm. This is a great signal. And then when we get it in the right time frame and it all lines up, we know that they're getting better.
So you said that was about 2 to 3 weeks in. How realistic is it to turn you around from not sleeping that great to actually sleeping well?
It really varies. You know, like the research on cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, so CBTI, the research can vary. There's sometimes 2 sessions. I've had patients that are super motivated, not that complicated. They're not on any medication. Mm-hmm. 2-3 sessions. I've had patients, I would say the average is 6 to 8 sessions, but then some, it can take a lot longer. You know, some people have had insomnia for 20, 30 years. Mm. But that being said, some people have had insomnia 20, 30 years and they get better in 2-3 sessions. Mm. It really varies, but it should not be a long-term treatment. If you're doing everything that we suggest and it's still not working after a few months, then we need to look at other factors that might be interfering or other treatment options.
And cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So my understanding of cognitive behavioral therapy is it's about changing thought processes.
Yeah. So it's kind of a funky misnomer in my opinion, because we talk about CBT a lot for anxiety and depression. It is that for this treatment, but it's a little bit different too. So like most of the people that I know, at least at home, they do it, but they don't do it for insomnia. They do it for depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So it is changing your thoughts. So when we do it with insomnia, it's changing. What I hear people say all day long is, if I don't sleep tonight, I won't be able to function tomorrow. And so it's changing.
That's trash talk.
It's trash talk. So it's changing. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right? What does function mean to you? Because it means something different to almost everybody. Mm-hmm. And changing their negative framework of thinking at 2 a.m. because the rational part of your brain is not working at 2 in the morning. So challenging the thoughts that you're having about not sleeping and being aware of the thoughts that you're having, trying to force yourself to sleep. So I have to sleep tonight, otherwise XYZ won't happen. People start to dread the night as it gets closer if you have insomnia, and that's not good either. So it's being aware of those thoughts and how to challenge them rationally. If you have evidence for these thoughts actually being true, then we learn to problem solve it. It's not about happy thinking and positive thinking all day long. It's being realistic. Then the behavior part is all the sleep hygiene stuff. It's not laying in bed awake, tossing and turning, figuring out other things to do if you can't sleep, and then changing the sleep timing. And then we throw in mindfulness, relaxation. It's a whole treatment package. That's where CBTI comes in. It's a little different from the depression and anxiety stuff, but the cognitive part's very similar.
It's outlined really well in the book, actually.
Thank you.
Which I really appreciate, because I do know that this book is staying on my bookshelf, because I'm going to, I don't want to say relapse, but I'm definitely going to go through periods again, because I always have.
I mean, that's it. And I make sure to say to patients, you shouldn't ever say you're cured, right? It's a chronic thing that we have when it comes to insomnia. Yeah. Stress happens, medical changes happen, hormones happen. You just have to take out your treatment, whether it's medication, behavioral, whatever it is, do another shot of the treatment, and then you get back on track again.
You have to roll with it.
Roll with it.
What does it mean when you're able to fall asleep, but you wake up at 2 a.m. and then that's it? And then you fall back to sleep at around 6, 7 o'clock.
And then you sleep until what? That's the...
Well, I'm talking very specifically about something that happened to me when I went through a period of stress at work. And it was I think it was well over a year. So I'd be able to fall asleep around midnight. I'd be up at 2. My mind would be racing. Then I'd fall asleep at around 6, 7 o'clock. But then I would go into a deep sleep and sort of foggily wake up at 9. But it meant that I stopped exercising, because I lost that crucial 2-hour window in the morning to be able to run. So it impacted massively on my life, actually.
It's horrible.
Yeah. But fundamentally, because this isn't about me, listeners, this is about you. Fundamentally, there is a reason why you tend to wake up between 2 and 3. Is it a cortisol jump?
It can be a cortisol jump. Yeah, that's often what happens. You wake up, a lot of women who are perimenopausal, they'll wake up at that time. They'll find that their brains are just active, but there's usually a cortisol jump. Usually we have those middle of the night or early morning awakenings because of some sort of stress or anxiety that's happening.
So it's a really good... this podcast, we've tried to talk about the fact that anxiety, depression, all of these things that happen, they're your body giving you in a vehicle where you get the red light saying, tire's flat.
Yeah.
It's your body saying something else needs to be addressed.
100%. And what I often say to people too is, if you go to sleep without any issue, but you're going to sleep and you're doing work or you're thinking about the stressful things within that hour before going to bed, you might be sleepy enough to override thinking about it when you go to bed. But now you go to bed and you sleep for maybe 2-3 hours. now you're going to wake up because you have, we naturally awaken throughout the night anyways. That's fine. But you go right back to sleep. But now you've had that sleepiness lifted a bit because you've taken essentially a long nap for a few hours. Whatever was on your brain right before you went to bed is going to be right there when you get up. But now you're not as sleepy because you slept for a few hours. So it's going to be right there now.
Right.
So there are different ways to address it. One could be actually, it seems a little bit torturous, but to go to bed later or wake up earlier, don't have that sleep in the morning thing, because that's that common sense thing, right? I'm going to try and catch what I can. But that's a big window, 12 to 9.
It's too early to get up, so I'll just...
Exactly. Yeah. But if you break that cycle, it's painful to do at the beginning, but if you break that cycle, sometimes you do start consolidating your sleep after a few weeks. But then it's also figuring out, what can I do mindfulness-wise, relaxation-wise, in the beginning of the night, the hour before bed, and then also figuring out what you're doing in the middle of the night. So there are definitely... there can be cognitive factors, worry control techniques, relaxation techniques, not laying in bed tossing and turning. People are often on their phones in the middle of the night trying to distract themselves. There are things that you should be doing, just not laying there tossing and turning, that are actually worsening it.
Is the I'm trying to think what the best way to describe this particular thing is, but is there a way of, well, what mindfulness do you promote? What do you think works best for people?
Whatever you can do. That's how I look at it. Right. I don't really think that there's one more than another. I practice it myself, but I do it. I don't have a formal mindfulness practice where I sit for 10 minutes every morning. I'm a runner, and I run 5-6 days a week. And I like to, when I go running, I like to try and make a good 5 minutes into a mindfulness practice. I just turn off whatever I'm watching or listening to, and I just notice my thoughts. And then try to just be aware of them and let them go, and then just focus on my breath usually as I'm running. I also turn just other moments throughout the day into mindfulness practice. So I don't like doing the dishes. I just get so angry when I'm doing the dishes and have to put them even just in the dishwasher. Yeah. I don't know why I have to wash off a dish before I put it in the dishwasher. But anyways, so I get so frustrated with it. So I try to make that into a mindfulness practice. So I'll sit there and I'll just feel the soap or the water on my hands for 30 seconds even, and just try to notice my frustration thoughts and just notice them drift away and just focus on the warmth of the water, the suds, describe what I see, little things like that. When I get a manicure, I never used to sit and let them massage, or they'd massage my hands, but I would never focus on that. I'd think about 8 million other things I had to do. Now I always sit and I just, that 2 minutes or however long they're doing a massage for on my hands, I sit and I focus on the feeling of that massage. That's a meditation or a mindfulness. It's always just being in the present moment. So that's how I practice it, because I think of it like a muscle that you're strengthening in your brain to be able to be aware of the thoughts you're having and just let them pass. And you can do it in a very focused exercise where you're sitting, being mindful of what you're eating, sitting for 5 minutes in the morning, when you get up, listen to the noises around you, look at the weather, whatever it is. But if you strengthen that muscle in very focused practices, when you go to bed at night, it will help you to be much more aware of being aware of the thoughts that you're having. Oh, am I going to sleep tonight? I have this to do tomorrow. And then just say, nope, not now. Let me almost draw like a thought cloud or a bubble around it and let it pass. And then get back on, just focus on your breathing as you're going to sleep. That's how I practice mindfulness. I don't actually love people falling asleep in the middle of meditations, because that's not how they're meant to be done. They're meant to be done when you're awake, not asleep. So it's really meant to just help you be more aware of your thoughts and help to kind of let them pass, to focus on the ability to fall asleep.
And what about breathing? I find if I get into bed and I think, oh, it doesn't feel like it's going to happen tonight, that's when I'll just try and do actually Dr. Rangan Chatterjee's technique, the 3-4-5 breath that he did when he came on the podcast. Just 3 in, hold for 4, 5 out.
Yep, you can totally do that. I tell it, the rule of thumb when it comes to sleep, though, is usually we tell people not to stay in bed for more than 20 or so minutes. Because if you're in bed,
they're struggling.
If you're struggling. So if you're in bed for more than 20 minutes, and I don't like the clock, I don't want clock watching other than having an alarm clock in the morning. So I don't want you looking at the clock. So guesstimate. So if you're doing that exercise and you keep doing it, but now you're lying there for a while, it's not working. You're fooling yourself. Get up, go sit somewhere else. Do the exercise elsewhere if you want. Then you can do a meditation practice. Do something without a screen. I don't care. Mm. Go back to bed when you're actually sleepy. But you can do it for a little while. But if it's just not working for a while, that's fine. I tend to do my own deep breathing. There's a bunch of, there's so many different ways to do it. I just do them where I breathe in, I say one, and then I exhale and I say relax. Mm. And I just keep doing that. I go up to 10 and back down to one. And if I've gone up to 10 and back down to one and haven't fallen asleep, then I know I fooled myself. I'm going to get out of bed and go sit somewhere else.
I very recently, it was actually at the Goop Summit when Elise Lunan came on the podcast. She invited me along. And in the goodie bag, they had the 5-minute journal, which I'd heard about for years. But actually, I find it a really nice thing to do. When you wake up, listeners, and it's all done for you. You just have to fill it out.
Yep.
And it takes 5 minutes.
Yep.
And then in the evening, you just kind of summarize the day. And I have found that to be actually incredibly valuable.
Exactly. Just like I was saying before, if it's on your brain right when you go to bed, it's going to be on your brain when you wake up at 2 a.m. So get it out. Mm-hmm. Write it down, whether it's journaling, whether it's a to-do list. If you have a lot of worries that are just the same worries over and over again, spend a little time, an hour before, writing them all down on a piece of paper for 10 minutes.
Where do you stand on supplementation? We're not talking about prescription drugs here.
No. I'm not opposed to it at all, but we try to treat sleep without anything at the beginning because that's how we're supposed to sleep. Mm. It really varies. You know, at least at home, most people tend to use melatonin. Mm. It's not regulated by any government agency and it's over the counter. Mm. And so people misuse it and it's not, you can get bottles that have one dose inside and another bottle will have a different dosage, even though they're all labeled the same. Right. So melatonin, it's helpful for some people. It's really great for jet lag and certain disorders, but not so much for insomnia. Mm. But I have patients who swear by it. But magnesium, some people use for a calming effect. When it comes to hormonal issues, plaque cohosh, there's definitely things that you can try, but I always encourage people to talk to their physician first, because just because it's over the counter doesn't mean it doesn't have interactions with medical disorders that you have, other medications that you might take. And just because it's over the counter doesn't mean it's not without side effects either. Mm. So people take melatonin at home like it's candy, but it can make you have more nightmares, more vivid dreams, make you feel dizzy during the day. It can be worse than some of the prescription medications.
I know what I want to ask you, because I know that we're on the clock a little bit. Sleep paralysis.
Oh, sleep paralysis. What about it? So just what is it? Or?
It happened to me again about 3 nights ago. Am I understanding it correctly that sleep paralysis is that when your brain wakes up, but your body doesn't.
You got it.
You're out of sync.
Yeah. So when we're in a stage of sleep called REM, so REM sleep, rapid eye movement, that's a stage of sleep where you're vividly dreaming, you're having memory consolidation. It's a really important stage of sleep. Our brains have a natural mechanism to protect us so our muscles don't move. Mm. So some people who have very violent, like acting out and sleepwalking kind of disorders, it's a whole other type of sleep disorder, but it's their muscles don't get turned off. So they're acting out their dreams.
So it's like when you see a dog dreaming about running.
That video, the dog probably had some sort of REM behavior disorder. It's not good. But sleep paralysis is essentially what happens is when you're in that stage of sleep, you're coming out of REM sleep, but your muscles haven't turned back on yet. It's common, but it often is a sign that you had some sort of sleep deprivation. Like I know someone who
100%. Uh-huh.
I know a number of people who've had it, and someone who will go nameless right now, who was in law school at the time, who had it because he was sleep deprived, and he just like woke up and was like that, and it was terrible because it was so sleep deprived. So my husband. But yeah, it was bad. But that was just because he was a law student. Yeah. And it can happen. And that's what you have to treat first. You just make sure your sleep quality is good. Mm. You're getting enough sleep on a regular basis. If you continue to have it, though, despite getting enough sleep, you definitely want to get it evaluated, because it can be a sign of other sleep disorders or other, sometimes medication can cause it. You want to get it evaluated. Yeah. But the first thing is it's sleep deprivation.
Yeah, I was very, very overtired. I really overdid it at the weekend with work and then went to a lovely family thing. It happened the night after.
Yeah.
But I knew it was happening because I thought that my front door was being opened. I thought I could hear all the machinations. And so I was like, I'm going to shout out, don't come in here.
Yeah.
And I went, okay, this is sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
So there was some kind of...
You at least knew what it was.
Yes.
When people have it for the first time, it's terrifying.
Well, some people report that they feel like something's getting closer to them or something sits on their chest.
There is a really I forgot the name of the painting. Yeah. And it's like, it's a monster sitting on its chest.
A little demon.
Yeah, a demon. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
But really, there is no demon. It is the fact that your brain and your body are out of sync.
Yeah, great. Out of sync.
See, I like offering comfort because when it happens, it can be really scary.
Yeah. And there are, like I said, you know, if you're someone who's having not just sleepwalking, but you're fighting in bed, you're hurting yourself or someone else, and it's much more of a violent thing, you need to get that evaluated for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I was going to say, it's so comforting to know that this affects a lot of people and that it can sometimes feel like a very lonely thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it actually isn't. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about actually was sleep positioning.
Yeah.
I have, well, is there an optimum sleep position?
You know,
it's different from everybody,
isn't
it?
It's different from everybody. It depends who you ask. Like, if you ask an orthopedist or a chiropractor or someone, they probably have their own specific opinions. But I always look at it as just, you know, what's going to get you the best sleep at night? If you're someone who has chronic pain, just wherever you're most comfortable. But that being said, if you snore a lot, if you've been diagnosed with sleep apnea and they told you that you snore most on your back, then you need to train yourself to sleep on your side. Because there are some mild forms of snoring and sleep apnea where you just have to sleep on your side or your stomach and it fixes the problem. And you can train yourself very easily to do that. So there are fancy pillows, or not pillows, there are fancy t-shirts that have bumps on the back that train you to just sleep on your side. I honestly just have people wear either a fanny pack or a pocket tee with a tennis ball that's sewn in the back, and they wear it backwards. And it just trains you so that you don't roll on your back. That's it.
That's
super easy.
That's an interesting
one. A lot of my friends will complain that their husbands snore. Yeah, and they snore and they just don't want to like keep elbowing them in the middle of the night to roll on their side. So this is the solution that they've come up with so they both can sleep well.
Golf ball in the waistband.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
I've heard that one before. I actually weirdly recently have been, because I'm normally a front sleeper, but I'm sort of, I throw myself on my front, like if I get frustrated that I'm not sleeping. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe this will work.
Yeah.
And I end up sort of ending up really far down the bed.
Yeah.
Which is just weird with my, and I'm not tall. So I'm like, and I recently decided to get pillows and kind of almost like pad myself in and sleep slightly propped up. I've been sleeping like a dream apart from the paralysis.
Yeah. No, it's comfort. It's really comfort. And the number of people I have who say, I have to have a body pillow. I have to have this, you know, it's whatever works for you, but you do have to be cognizant of, is it something that's so rigid that if you can, can you take it with you? Or is it something where like people will complain then if they get a bed partner or if they're traveling, can they bring everything with them? Are they willing to have a night where they're not necessarily going to have all that stuff set up perfectly?
Yeah. Yes. Because you can't.
Not right. That's night. The training stuff I'm talking about. Like you need all these things to be able to sleep well. What if it's not always there?
Yeah. And it's like, we go to the gym, we work with personal trainers. I know some, I'm sure listeners, you've worked with a personal trainer or at least have had guidance.
Yeah.
And actually, when you think about it, you spend a third of your life in bed. It makes sense to have someone like you on hand.
Yeah.
To kind of hold your hand through the tough spells.
Right. Exactly. And I say this all the time. It's, we focus so much on diet and exercise as being pillars of wellness. We don't focus on the sleep, and I don't understand it. We're starting to more and more, but it's not at the same level, and we need to, because it's really going to affect the other areas of our lives.
You're totally right. You understand the foods that don't agree with you. You understand the food that make you feel full, make you feel gassy, but then we haven't really, and it's quite rigid. Like but actually having a rigid understanding of what makes you sleep well.
And we see very frequently in research that when people start to become anxious and depressed, like clinically, sleep is often the first thing to go. But we don't always think about it. We just kind of power through. And then you get to the point where you haven't treated your sleep or done anything about it, that now you're clinically depressed. Like if we had just addressed the sleep, just like we're addressing other things, we could really make so much more headway in the other things that we're looking at and trying to treat in our society.
This has been such a fascinating conversation. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've learned so much. And this book, The Women's Guide to Overcoming Insomnia, Get a Good Night's Sleep Without Relying on Medication is the subtitle, is honestly, I feel like I wish I'd read this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, because I now feel like when I do wake up in the middle of the night and I won't put my phone on, if I am struggling and I think, oh, this isn't just, this is something else, this is a couple of nights in a row, this I'll be able to go into the section. I'll be able to practice things.
You're so kind. Thank you.
Thank you for writing this book.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I want people to really just better themselves in so many areas. And I really hope that a lot of people get a lot of help from it.
It's been such a delight to talk to you. Listeners, obviously the links to Dr. Shelby Harris will be in the show notes. The link to the book will be in the show notes. But thank you for your time so much.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Now, before you go, I just want to remind you how easy it is to get in touch with me. Email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM me on social media. I'm at Emma Gunns, that's at EMMAGUNS on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to have a chat with me and over 3,000 other listeners of The Emma Gunns Show, then simply go to the show notes, which can be found wherever you are streaming and downloading this episode, and click the link to join. You have to answer those three questions, otherwise you won't get in, but answer those three questions and the forum will open before you. Can't wait to see you there. Get your emails, get your DMs, just hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you on the next one.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.